Hello, welcome. Shall we begin a new chapter? This time it's chapter 24, Gnosis and Ananda. It was published in November 1917 on the 15th day of the month. The first article in the issue was The Life Divine. The Ascent and Its Downward Eye. Provocative in leading to this chapter. So this another example of something that went through lengthy rewriting around 1932. I think it might be worth reading both versions. Let's begin with how he originally wrote it and then come back to how it stands after he's reconsidered. So this is from the Arya. The ascent to the Gnosis and the possession of the Gnostic consciousness raise both the soul of man and his life in the world to a glory of light and power and bliss and infinity, which seems, in comparison with the lame action and limited realization of the mental being, the very status and dynamis of an absolute perfection. And it is perfection, which nothing before it has been, for even the highest spiritual realization on the plane of mentality has in it something top-heavy, one-sided, and exclusive, and the widest is marred by its imperfect power of self-expression in life. But in comparison with what is beyond it, it is only a relative perfection, or it is the last step from which we can securely ascend into the absolute infinities, which are the origin and the goal of the incarnating spirit. And we can see in the first phrases he marks it differently. So here is the revision from roughly 1932. The ascent to the Gnosis, the possession of something of the Gnostic consciousness, must elevate the soul of man and sublimate his life in the world into a glory of light and power and bliss and infinity that can seem in comparison with the lame action and limited realizations of our present mental and physical existence, the very status and dynamis of a perfection, final and absolute. And it is a true perfection, such as nothing before it has yet been in the ascension of the Spirit. For even the highest spiritual realization on the plane of mentality has in it something top-heavy, one-sided, and exclusive. Even the widest mental spirituality is not wide enough, and it is marred too by its imperfect power of self-expression in life. And yet, in comparison with what is beyond it, this too, this first Gnostic splendor is only a bright passage to a more perfect perfection. It is the secure and shining step from which we can happily mount still upwards into the absolute infinities, which are the origin and the goal of the incarnating spirit. In this farther ascension, the Gnosis does not disappear, but reaches rather its own supreme light out of which it has descended to mediate between mind and the Supreme Infinite. So I think you can see it's sharply different. It's nuanced. And it reflects the experience of a pioneer who has indeed climbed and climbed. And let's remember that the word ascend means to climb up. The ascent to the gnosis. And then the last sentence, in this farther ascension, the gnosis does not disappear. So he is a mountaineer of consciousness, striding on the Himalayas into the supreme light, Paramjyoti. Which has, in a sense, reached down, nimbly mediated between that Supreme Infinite above and the mind, which will catch some of its luster and share it with the involving universe. First it has to involve, then it may evolve. So the first work in the construction of a cosmos is to build the interior dimensions of the mansion. This universe has first an interior, then it has an exterior. And through the exterior, we climb the scaffolding back towards that supreme light. So now he goes into this next bit. The Upanishad tells us that after the knowledge self above the mental is possessed, and all the lower cells have been drawn up into it, there is another and last step of all that still left to us. But one might ask, is it eternally the last or only the last practically conceivable or at all necessary for us now to take up our Gnostic existence into the bliss self and there complete the spiritual self-discovery of the divine infinite? So here he's speaking directly about the Taittiriya Upanishad, one of the oldest, one of the three or four oldest of Upanishads that we have left to us. The knowledge self, that's the Vijnana Maya, above the mental. So if you remember when Bhrigu is climbing at his father's direction from plane to plane, discovering what is finally real, he begins with matter, with food, annam, proceeds to prana, then to manas, but exceeds manas and lands in this vast consciousness of vijnana, but does not stop with that, proceeds even farther and winds his journey up in the land of bliss. That infinite nature of the divine is there. And you'll read that in the Taittiriya Upanishad in sections 2 and 3. The Brahmananda Valley and the Bhrigu Valley. But I'm going to draw your attention again to the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is the oldest Upanishad. And there, if you look in the, we'll call it the third chapter in the ninth section and the 28th verse. It says something like this in English. Brahman is knowledge, is bliss, the final goal of the giver of offerings. Of him too, who stands still and knows. Vijnanam Anandam Brahma. All these hierarchies are there in the very oldest Upanishad. So let's see what he says. to take up our Gnostic existence, in other words, to have arrived at Vijnanamaya, and then ranged upward from there into the bliss self. And the Upanishad, both Brihadaranyaka and Taittiriya have interesting things to say about that. Let's read in English, if we can, from Brihadaranyaka. Non-existent, asat, was this world in the beginning. Therefore, was existence produced. Remember Sri Aurobindo in his earliest chapters of The Life Divine saying that there is no real asat, but it is reality refusing to be even dictated to by its reality. That it is free absolutely from even its self-definition. So from asat, sat comes. That made itself a soul, an atman. It made itself into a self. So from this non-existent, which then decides, well, I am after all, and who can I be if I am but a self, and a supreme self at that. This, by the way, is section 2, no, let me say it again, chapter 2, section 7, in the first verse. Verily, what that well-made is, sukrutam, well-constructed, well-built, what that well-made is, that verily is the essence of existence. So this sat, which is made, this is the first act. That is beautifully, well, auspiciously formed. For truly, on getting the essence, knowing this, entering into this sat, one becomes blissful. One is filled with ananda. For who indeed could live, who could breathe, if there were not this bliss in space? This verily is it that bestows bliss. Knowing that, becoming one with that, this is what, I really am. I am impartible. I am immortal. I am all of this. All of that is me. We are all one. Only that is. Nothing can be destroyed. Forms can change. Dramas can be produced. But that never moves. This verily is it that bestows bliss. For truly, when one finds fearlessness, abhaya, as support in him who is invisible, bodiless, undefined, without support, doesn't need to be supported, then has he reached fearlessness, abhaya. When, however, this soul makes in this one the smallest interval, the breadth of a hair, then for him there is fear. That truly is the fear of the knower who does not reflect. Now, that is in the Taittiriya Upanishad. I hope I said that. I might have said that it was the Brihadaranyaka. If I did, I was in error. That's Taittiriya 271. So we're going to play with some verbs tonight. Ascend, descend, reflect. Let's continue now. To take up our Gnostic existence into the bliss self and there complete the spiritual self-discovery of the divine infinite. An echo of this Upanishad, no? Ananda, a supreme bliss eternal, far other and higher in its character than the highest human joy or pleasure, is the essential and original nature of the spirit. And if you read the Taittiriya, you'll see that it engages an interesting arithmetic in its later sections as how many joys equal a touch of Ananda. In Ananda, our spirit will find its true self. In Ananda, its essential consciousness. In Ananda, the absolute power of its existence. So, all of Satchit Ananda has been compressed into this sentence. Ananda is the core of Satchit Ananda. So, some like to take it that Sat comes first. No. All about it. None is absent of any. The embodied soul's entry into this highest absolute, unlimited, unconditional bliss of the spirit is the infinite liberation and the infinite perfection. It is true that something of this bliss can be enjoyed by reflection, by a qualified descent, even on the lower planes where the Purusha plays with his modified and qualified nature. So descent means to climb down. Ascend, to climb up. Descend, to climb down. It is one soul who climbs above and descends below. Only one. This bliss can be enjoyed by reflection. Remember in the last chapters we've been reading how often Sankhya came into it. Above, all is identity of spirit. There is no need for reflection because there is utter oneness. But when there comes the sharp division of the mind in the involution of the spirit, because it can't hold the infinity of what is the vijnana or the supermind. Now, the soul in its relationship with nature, they are not one and the same, but they agree in a sense to separate. And the one reflects the other, and Purusha reflects Prakriti in its own being. And we see the consciousness of Purusha in the play of Prakriti. But consciousness really belongs to Purusha. So it's reflected. So now, something of this bliss can be enjoyed by reflection. So when we experience bliss here in the world, well, we're experiencing an aspect of it, not it in its integrity. It is immanent here, yes, and we'll touch upon that in a moment. But it can be, one can declare oneness at every level, yes. We can feel one with all in the physical world, in the vital world, in the mental world, but can we feel it utterly? Anybody can say everything is united. What does it mean? What is the depth of the experience? How far has one plumbed? How vast has one become? How high has one climbed? So a qualified descent, even on the lower planes where the Purusha plays with his modified and qualified nature. So this is not the original Shakti above. This is Prakriti. This is the working of nature. There can be the experience of a spiritual and boundless ananda on the plane of matter, on the plane of life, on the plane of mind, as well as on the Gnostic truth plane of knowledge and above it. And the yogin who enters into these lesser realizations may find them so complete and compelling that he will imagine there is nothing greater, nothing beyond it, for each of the divine principles contains in itself the whole potentiality of all the other six notes of our being. Each plane of nature can have its own perfection of these notes under its own conditions. This is the point we've made previously in an earlier chapter. But the integral perfection, where it all comes to oneness, can come only by a mounting ascent of the lowest into the highest and an incessant descent of the highest into the lowest, till all becomes one at once, solid block and plastic sea stuff of the truth infinite and eternal. So he connotes here, when he uses the term solid, that this is the real, this is the foundation, this is the base. But it's the plastic sea stuff too. Sri Aurobindo has been consistent in his work in the Veda, in his work in the life divine, when images of water, when symbolism of water comes into play. It is the movement, the many-sided movement of consciousness that is key. So, a mounting ascent and a descent. But here he's placing all of this in the experience of ananda. The very physical consciousness in man, the anamaya purusha, can, without this supreme ascent and integral descent, yet reflect and enter into the self of satchit ananda. So here's the Sankhya again. It can do it either by a reflection of the soul in physical nature, its bliss, power, and infinity, secret, but still present here. So again, sat is a corollary of matter in the involution. Power and infinity, secret, but still present here, or by losing its separate sense of substance and existence in the self within or without it. The result is a glorified sleep of the physical mind, in which the physical being forgets itself in a kind of conscious nirvana, or else moves about like a thing inert in the hands of nature, jadavat, like a leaf in the wind, or otherwise a state of pure and happy and free irresponsibility of action, balavat, a divine childhood. Well, the jadavat is the, you might say, knowledge made inert and tamasic, and balavat, knowledge made dynamic and rajasic. But this comes without the higher glories of knowledge and delight, which belong to the same status upon a more exalted level. It is an inert realization of satchit ananda, in which there is neither any mastery of the prakriti by the purusha, nor any sublimation of nature into her own supreme power, the infinite glories of the parashakti. So inert and unaccomplished, there is no siddhi here. There is no mastery. There is no climbing up into a new range, because the relationship of soul and nature, Purusha and Prakriti, at the level of matter, at the level of prana, life, at the level of mind, is a relationship of division and distance, where if Prakriti sees consciousness, it sees it by reflection in itself, thinks it possesses it. So the oneness is not there. Yet these two, this mastery and this sublimation, are the two gates of perfection, the splendid doors into the supreme eternal. So if we cannot master and control our nature, if consciousness does not become powerful and can render plastic the instrument, the vehicle in which it rides, then our work has not been done. And if there is no sublimation, if we have not taken that vehicle into the higher sphere, if we have not ridden Indra's cart, his chariot, and reached the higher consciousness, then we have not reached. We have neither done nor have we ascended. So perfection, siddhi, fulfillment eludes us. The life soul and life consciousness in man, pranamaya purusha, can in the same way directly reflect and enter into the self of Satchit Ananda by a large and splendid and blissful reflection of the soul in universal life, or by losing its separate sense of life and existence in the vast self within or without it. The result is either a profound state of sheer self-oblivion, or else an action driven irresponsibly by the life nature, an exalted enthusiasm of self-abandonment to the great world energy in its vitalistic dance. The outer being lives in a God-possessed frenzy, careless of itself and the world, unmatavat, which means like a madman, or with an entire disregard, whether of the conventions and proprieties of fitting human action, or of the harmony and rhythms of a greater truth. It acts as the unbound vital being, Pishachavat, the divine maniac, or else the divine demoniac. Here too there is no mastery or supreme sublimation of nature. There is only a joyful, static possession by the self within us, and an unregulated dynamic possession by the physical and the vital nature without us. So Sri Aurobindo has not denied that there is a liberation, it's inside, but it does not have instrumental impact. It does not change the modes of nature. It does not sublimate Prakriti. It leaves it as it finds it and lets it work its old, well-known order. The mind soul and mind consciousness in man, manomaya purusha, can in the same direct way reflect and enter into Satchit Ananda by a reflection of the soul as it mirrors itself in the nature of pure universal mind, luminous, unwalled, happy, plastic, illimitable, or by absorption in the vast, free, unconditioned, uncentered self within it and without it. So here's the experience of the infinite self whose center is nowhere and whose circumference is everywhere. Problem is that it's just in the mind and it doesn't relate again to nature. It is a liberation, but it is not the liberation. The result is either the immobile size... I'll start again. The result is either the immobile cessation of all mind and action, or a desire-free, unbound action watched by the unparticipating inner witness. The mental being becomes the eremite soul, in other words, a recluse or a hermit, alone in the world, and careless of all human ties, or the saint soul that lives in a rapturous God-nearness, or felicitous identity, and in joyful relations of pure love and ecstasy towards all creatures. Wonderful, but incomplete. Then he is all these things, alternately, successively, or at once, or he may transform the lower forms into manifestations of the higher state. He may draw upward the childlikeness or the inert irresponsibility of the free physical mind or the free vital mind's divine madness and carelessness of all rules, proprieties, harmonies, and color, or disguise with them the ecstasy of the saint or the solitary liberty of the wandering eremite. Here again, there is no mastery, no sublimation of the nature by the soul in the world, but a double possession by the freedom and delight of the mental, spiritual, infinite within and without, by the happy, natural, and unregulated play of the mind nature. But since the mental being is capable of receiving the gnosis in a way in which the life soul and physical soul cannot receive it, since he can accept it with knowledge, though only the limited knowledge of a mental response, he may, to a certain extent, govern by its light his outer action, or if not that, at least bathe and purify in it his will and his thinkings. Ah, but mind can arrive only at a compromise between the infinite within and the finite nature without. It cannot pour the infinity of the inner being's knowledge and power and bliss with any sense of fullness into its external action, which remains always inadequate. Still, it is content and free, because it is the Lord within who takes up the responsibility of the action, adequate or inadequate, assumes its guidance, and fixes its consequence. So we see here a summary of previous traditions of perfection in Indian spirituality, whether they're theistic, whether they're Vedantic. They can, indeed, glorify life to an extent, impart a great influence, uplift, purify, but they do not divinize. Not in the way that Sri Aurobindo sees an integral being at the end of a transformative progress. So he continues, but the Gnostic soul, the Vijnanamaya Purusha, is the first to participate not only in the freedom, but in the power and sovereignty of the eternal. So when we get there, consciousness is rejoining power. It's closer to, it's a distributed action of Chit Shakti, who are one. Knowledge and will, consciousness and power, are not divided in Chit Shakti, and they also are not divided as described by itself in the Vijnana. And back, he's talking about the Gnostic soul here, so that being who is becoming filled with the inner radiance of true knowledge based on identity, for it receives the fullness. It has the sense of plenitude of the Godhead in its action. Purnam madaha, purnam idam. It shares the free, splendid, and royal march of the infinite, is a vessel of the original knowledge, the immaculate power, the inviolable bliss, transmutes all life into the eternal light and the eternal fire and the eternal wine of the nectar. It possesses the infinite of the self, and it possesses the infinite of nature. It does not so much lose as find its nature's self in the self of the infinite. So we're rejoining here Purusha and Prakriti, but can we even call them Purusha and Prakriti anymore? Is the soul separate from nature? Is nature devoid of soul? On the other planes to which the mental being has easier access, man finds God in himself and himself in God. He becomes divine in essence rather than in person or nature. In the gnosis, even the mentalized gnosis, the divine eternal possesses, changes, and stamps the human symbol, envelops and partly finds himself in the person and nature. So here we have a reconnection, a reintegration. And we see that Sri Aurobindo is likely speaking of his own personal experience and evolution here, because he is drawing into himself the light of the supramental, and it is having a profound impact on all the orders of his being, moving through all the hallways and rooms of his personal mansion. In the gnosis, the dualism of Purusha and Prakriti, soul and nature, two separate powers complementary to each other, the great truth of the Sankhyas, founded on the practical truth of our present natural existence, disappears in their biune entity, the dynamic mystery of the occult supreme. And let's remember that the greatest power of knowledge is identity, that which sees the one, that which sees the essence in the dynamism, and whose consciousness is so powerful that it enforces unity. Where it doesn't exist, it creates it, hence its power to transform the lower existence. So this seeming separation of soul and nature disappears into biunity, two in one, the dynamic mystery of the occult supreme. Occult, hidden. The supreme is here, present, never absent. We think we're not one with all, but we are dynamically, even if it is secret. And this echoes all that we've read in the Life Divine in previous years. The truth being is the Haragauri of the Indian iconological symbol. It is the double power, masculine, feminine, born from and supported by the supreme Shakti of the supreme. He has a note. The biune body of the Lord and his spouse, Ishwara and Shakti, the right half male, the left half female. So this is Shiva and Parvati, Ardhanarishwara, the Lord who is both, or half and half, however you like to phrase it. But power is not absent. Consciousness and mastery is present in every wave of cognition. Perfection is the result of each wave of motion. So we'll go through and read another few pages next time we get together. I thought this section in Book One, the Book of Beginnings, might be interesting for us. It's in Canto 5, the Yoga of the Spirit's Freedom and Greatness. We can read some of it tonight and the rest of it later. A giant order was discovered here, of which the tassel and extended fringe are the scant stuff of our material lives. This overt universe, whose figures hide the secrets merged in superconscient light, wrote clear the letters of its glowing code. A map of subtle signs surpassing thought was hung upon a wall of the inmost mind, illumining the world's concrete images into significant symbols by its gloss. It offered to the intuitive exegete its reflex of the eternal mystery. Ascending and descending twixt life's poles, the serried kingdoms of the graded law plunged from the everlasting into time. Then, glad of a glory of multitudinous mind and rich with life's adventure and delight, and packed with the beauty of matter's shapes and hues, climbed back from time into undying self, up a golden ladder carrying the soul, tying with diamond threads the spirit's extremes. In this drop from consciousness to consciousness, each leaned on the occult in conscience power, the fountain of its needed ignorance, archmason of the limits by which it lives. In this soar from consciousness to consciousness, each lifted tops to that from which it came, origin of all that it had ever been, and home of all that it could still become. An organ scale of the eternal's acts, mounting to their climax in an endless calm, paces of the many-visaged wonderful, predestined stadia of the evolving way, measures of the stature of the growing soul, they interpreted existence to itself, and mediating twixt the heights and deeps, united the veiled married opposites, and linked creation to the ineffable. A last high world was seen, where all worlds meet. In its summit gleam, where night is not nor sleep, the light began of the Trinity Supreme. All there discovered what it seeks for here. It freed the finite into boundlessness and rose into its own eternities. The inconscient found its heart of consciousness, the idea in feeling, groping in ignorance, at last clutched passionately the body of truth. The music born in matter's silences, plucked nude out of the ineffable's fathomlessness, the meaning it had held but could not voice. The perfect rhythm, now only sometimes dreamed, an answer brought to the torn earth's hungry need, rending the night that had concealed the unknown, giving to her her lost, forgotten soul. Namaste. Jai Ma.